Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel from the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, an associate professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. Today we'll be getting into more political economy, looking at the evolution of labor activism in China. Our guest is Professor Manfred Elfstrom from the Department of Economics, Philosophy, and Political Science at the University of British Columbia, Okanagan. He received his PhD from Cornell University and previously held postdoctoral fellowships at the University of Southern California and at Harvard University. We're going to be talking about his book, Workers and Change in China, Resistance, Repression, Responsiveness. This book just came out this year from Cambridge University Press as part of its prestigious series, Cambridge Studies in Contentious Politics. So Manfred, thanks so much for joining us. First off, why don't you tell us a little bit of background about yourself and how you got interested in the topic of worker activism in China?
Well, thanks, first of all, so much for having me. In terms of how I got into the project. In grad school, I was told that you're supposed to start with a dependent variable side puzzle and essentially work backward, find something unusual, some unusual outcome or contrast. But my project was born out of my interest in what, if any, outcome something I'd been involved in for a while, namely labor activism in China, might be having over the long haul. So in other words, it was a independent variable focused project. I'd worked for a number of years with groups in the States supporting workers' rights and improved grassroots governance in China, and I just wanted to know what it all added up to.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you did in your pre-grad school life? Like what was your involvement?
So what I was involved with for the longest period was a set of programs run by a group called International Labor Rights Forum, based out of Washington, D.C. And on the one hand, we supported labor law clinics in Chinese law schools, basically training young law students on labor side litigation in the hopes that some of them would take on workers' cases when they graduated. And then on the other hand, we worked with grassroots labor NGOs, mostly down in the Pearl River Delta. I also spent a little bit of time with a small group in New York that does sort of muckraking investigations called China Labor Watch.
Okay, so you had this, you've been working in this area, and you're saying you sort of took that as your, in the jargon, your independent variable. You're saying, there's all this labor activism, and you're trying to help out with it, from the States, with these different groups. And the question is, what, if anything, was actually being achieved? Is that right?
Exactly. I put in a couple years in this work, and when you're in the midst of running programs, you're basically spending most of your bandwidth on tracking balance sheets, following up with project partners, following the day-to-day news, but you're not able to step back and sort of see where it's all going. And that's what I wanted to do when I went to grad school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's what academics are for, right? Getting taking that step back and having the time to be thoughtful and design research to to look at the big picture or to look at smaller pictures in a more more precise way. All right, so getting into the actual topic, you know, as a socialist country, and there's different ways that you could think of, like, depending where people are coming from, what they might expect to be from China. Like, why don't you think of them as a socialist country where, you know, workers would be, you know, they're the proletariat, right? That's what Marxism is supposed to be all about. So you might expect them to be have a lot of influence in politics and get taken of, to get taken care of very well. Or on the other hand, you might be coming at it from the frame of, you know, autocracy, where you'd assume that any kind of, you know, strikes or street mobilization by ordinary citizens that wasn't explicitly, you know, mandated in the form of like parades by the state would get repressed. So what is actually happening in China? Like, how much, you know, worker activism is there, and what does it look like? Is it, you know, mass riots in the streets? Is it, you know, what's really happening? And I know there's a huge amount of variation. So the question is, yeah, what is the range of that variation as well?
I generally think of China as a post-socialist country. I think it shares a lot of characteristics with places in the former Soviet Union, with some parts of the Middle East. And I think that legacy from the past kind of cuts in two ways. On the one hand, I think the fact that China once proclaimed that it was a worker state has gotten in the way of dealing with labor abuses. For a while in the 80s, 90s, China basically sort of assumed a harmony of interest between employers and employees that didn't hold under state socialism under Mao, but really didn't hold once they introduced market reforms. And on the other hand, I think that pass is a real weapon for workers. It's something they can hold against the government in a way that, say, religious dissidents can't, or environmental campaigners can't necessarily, groups on China's periphery, so-called ethnic minorities, can't necessarily. So it's something that's gotten in the way of addressing really deep-seated issues in China's workplaces, but it's also maybe a resource for workers. In terms of what's going on the ground, basically everything is going on, and it's been going on at a really high level for the past couple decades. So you have, you know, small forms of shirking and going slow. You have petitions, legal attempts at getting back pay or compensation for work injuries. You have gathering outside of government buildings with banners or singing songs. You have blocking roads. I was stuck in traffic in Shenzhen for a couple hours a long time ago because a group of women from a nearby factory had linked arms across the highway. You have strikes. You have occupying shop floors, especially when factories are about to shut down so that the machinery isn't taken out before workers get what's due them. And in a couple still rare instances, you have linking up across factories and across cities even. So in the past couple years, you've had dock workers, crane operators, organized nationwide strikes. You've seen some similar things with truckers. So you have a wide variety of things going on. It's hard to nail down the exact scale because China doesn't keep official strike statistics. But the strike map that I've maintained and the more up-to-date map that China Labor Bulletin, Hong Kong-based advocacy group maintains, show thousands of incidents happening every year, which is, you know, multiples of what you have in the United States or European countries. So it's really a phenomenal level of unrest.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a great thing that, you know, that phrase unrest is really one that, you know, raises a lot of flags. And actually, that's a great point, what you made about, you know, China's socialist legacy, in a sense, being a barrier. You know, I think I was almost even, on behalf of many people in America thinking, oh, socialist legacy being a barrier towards, you know, moving towards marketization. But I think your point's a different one, that, you know, the socialist legacy, because it defined the workers as having identical interests as the state or the company. So then, you know, anything, there would be no reason for there to be an institution or any kind of framework in which, people could resolve disagreements, when they got to the point of like closing down factories or obviously opening up, new factories as foreign investors and private entrepreneurs of various sorts started then becoming the employers, whereas before it had all been government. In either case, there's no idea of, oh, of course, conflict is natural. You know, you're going to want yours and I'm going to want mine. And we've got to find a way to kind of work that out in a way that doesn't cause too much chaos or disruption unnecessarily, which is kind of what we aspire for with all the different, don't always achieve, but what we aspire to in developed countries. Everyone's got their own formula and no one's ever entirely happy, but that's the idea. In China, there's not even the idea that we need a formula to resolve this. And then you're saying, the idea of unrest is an interesting one. So last week, and I think this one will come out before our podcast, I interviewed Yao Li, who's was looking at protests as a phenomenon, which obviously overlaps a lot with your work. And I know you guys have collaborated more recently. Her interest is primarily on the political stability. Maybe we could, at a risk of jumping ahead a little bit, like you mentioned, a lot of the protests are, more typically, or not protests, I mean, labor activism more broadly might be more small scale, petitioning local government or, doing a work stoppage or even just a slowdown or, striking within one factory. But you did mention that, there have in recent years even been, you mentioned dock workers and truckers, like having a nationwide strike. So, that starts to sound like solidarity in Poland, which is kind of every autocrat's fear. So how do you, how do those come about and how are they dealt with by the state?
So that kind of linking up, I should emphasize again, is really rare. And maybe most disturbing for the state is when the linking up spills over social boundaries and takes on a kind of cross-class character. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, 2018, 2019, there was this well-known case where a group of Marxist students traveled to Shenzhen to support some protesting workers at an electronics factory called the JASIC factory. And that, I think, really set off alarm bells with the government. Students were detained, not just in Shenzhen, but back on their home campuses in Beijing and Nanjing and elsewhere, shoved into vans in broad daylight. And the student organizations that had been behind this were completely reorganized. So the Marxist student group at Beida went from, holding events for migrant workers in the evenings to reading books about Confucianism and Xi Jinping's thought and that kind of thing. Mm. So there was a sort of whole, comprehensive crackdown in that instance. When it doesn't quite reach that level, I think workers pushing the boundaries pushes the government to sort of jettison its sort of orthodox way of handling contention and move in a slightly more risk-taking direction. That is both being harsher than usual, but also maybe initiating some reforms that represent a little bit of a gamble.
Okay, yeah. So you're kind of getting here into a little bit of the theory of your book. So let's come back to that, but maybe to set the stage more now. Can you tell us, how did you investigate this topic? You mentioned the strike map, and I knew you did a lot of field work. Why don't you just give us a quick rundown of that? Obviously, it's very sensitive. So, it's not like you can do, I presume, a nationally representative, you know, survey, or, you know, just kind of go anywhere you want and talk to anywhere you want, anyone you want. So how do you manage it in a difficult research environment?
Yeah, I was maybe a little bit naive about how easy this would be because I had that background with labor NGOs, with international solidarity work, and because in that previous role, I'd been able to not just talk to the worker centers and the universities I mentioned, but also engage Chinese trade union officials and judges and arbitrators and stuff. I thought it would be fairly straightforward to pick up those old ties and just start knocking on doors. It wasn't. I think part of it is just that I was a PhD student, and there's not a lot to gain from talking to PhD students, and, you know, a tiny outside risk that they'll reveal something embarrassing. And part of it is just that the Xi era had started and things were a bit tighter even when I did my field work. But basically, I spent a chunk of time in the Pearl River Delta and a chunk of time in the Yangtze River Delta talking to labor activists, many of whom I already knew from my old work, talking to workers at their job sites, sometimes via activists, engaging business people as much as possible, and then slowly making the connections to be able to talk to some officials in the trade union, in the labor bureau, in different places. And all the while in my downtime, collecting yearbooks and assembling my statistics to look at the bigger picture.
Okay, so you focused on, I think this is relevant also, is you focused on the Yangtze Delta and the Pearl River Delta. So those are both, you know, basically for people that don't know China, like that's the area kind of near Shanghai and Hangzhou, and then the area between Guangzhou and Hong Kong. And both of those are, you know, really newly industrial, well, not completely new, but like industrial areas that are very internationally engaged and with a very large private or quasi-private market economy. So a lot of these, the labor disputes you would have been looking at there would be more with private or foreign-owned firms, as opposed to like the earlier waves of labor dispute in China that occurred like in the late 90s and early 2000s, which were more centered in like Northeast China and kind of the old decrepit steel mills and so forth.
Yeah, that's right. I chose these two places because they were, to my mind, the closest thing to similar areas you could find in China, similar in terms of their number of migrant workers, similar in terms of foreign investment, similar in terms of general development, but different in terms of their levels of labor unrest. Not dramatically different. They're both sort of on the high end. The Guangdong is kind of off the charts, but nonetheless different when it comes to what workers were doing. And maybe it's worth sort of emphasizing that the whole project, it's really focused on the last decade plus. Mm-hmm. And those cases kind of reflect that. If I had wanted to really have more to say about activism and state-owned enterprises and the Rust Belt, then I would have gone there as well.
Yeah, but that's definitely, you know, as you mentioned, that's not as much of a current issue. So I know it makes sense that you were focusing on those areas. So why don't we get into sort of how you you know, what your findings were? So the key starting point of your argument is that there are different recipes for resistance in different areas. So tell us more about what is a recipe for resistance, and you know, how can you, yeah, what is it? What are the differences between them? And then, you know, how does that lead to different outcomes?
Again, my real interest was in the outcome of worker militancy, but I didn't feel like I could address the outcome without at least, you know, dipping my toe into the causes of the militancy in the first place. And so at the beginning of the book, I sketch out a series of factors that seem to clump around more contained resistance on the one hand, and more outright transgressive resistance, or what Kevin O'Brien calls a more sort of intermediary boundary-spanning resistance on the other. And here I'm not, you know, reinventing the wheel. I'm not trying to come up with some sort of big universal law of why workers protest, but just kind of descriptively sort of pulling together the different things that seem to go into each of these kinds of activism. And more contained activism, I found, tends to occur where you have a more high-skilled work, heavier industries, that kind of thing. More boundary spanning or outright transgressive resistance, on the other hand, that tends to come where you have a lot of migrant workers, first of all, and where you have more sort of labor intensive light industries. And, you know, a little factor that, you know, cuts across different regions of the country then would be just transportation and logistics were associated with more radical action.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So what's so as you said, you know, this is, other people have looked at that a little bit before, but what is for you, how would you characterize the cutoff between kind of, or not the cutoff, but like, you know, what is contained and kind of accepted, you know, playing by the rules kind of activism versus this transgressive or boundary spanning? Could you give some examples of each, or like the key factors that make something, you know, kind of okay or kind of not okay from the government's perspective?
Yeah, it depends a little bit on the context. So some out of the way part of China that just hasn't experienced a lot of labor unrest, that place might experience it's really mild forms of activism as disruptive, you know, people petitioning, that kind of thing might be a big deal in those places, whereas doesn't really register in a place like Guangdong. But in general, the way I've divided things up is petitioning, bringing legal cases, maybe gathering on a particular shop floor, that kind of thing is contained. Making demands that basically don't exceed what the law provides for workers, that's also contained. When you get into more sort of boundary spanning stuff, you're talking about strikes, that is, you know, stopping production, protests that spill out into the streets, demands that maybe go beyond the letter of the law to include calls for more in terms of benefits, higher wages, that kind of thing. And when it comes to organizations linking up in a somewhat bigger way, maybe drawing in local non-governmental organizations. And when you're all the way out at the transgressive end of things, you're talking about large-scale strikes that are maintained for days. They aren't just a flash in the pan. Maybe the kind of linking up between factories or even provinces that I mentioned earlier, demands for much more in terms of wages, demands for institutional reforms like a reorganized enterprise level branch of China's official trade union, and the involvement of more sort of committed, movement-oriented activists, especially from more movement-oriented labor NGOs. Again, you know, this all depends a little bit on the context, but as you move down that spectrum from contained to more boundary-spanning and even transgressive activism, you put more pressure on the local government.
Okay, so so you're saying there's these different recipes for resistance, and then they, you know, result in so the recipe is kind of the background conditions of like what the economic situation is there, you know, who's employed and what kinds of industries, what kinds of grievances they have, and then this results in different forms of resistance. So it may take the more boundary spanning or transgressive form, or it may play by the rules more in this kind of constrained format. And then, you know, the next step of your argument is that there's then different counter strategies from local governments. So what are those counter strategies, and why do they choose them in response to these different kinds of resistance?
The default for local governments is what I call an orthodox way of handling unrest. So that means preempting things as much as possible. So really carefully monitoring workplaces and nipping burgeoning disputes in the bud. A caution when it comes to labor laws and the programming of local trade union branches. So just passing laws that tweak national guidelines in light of local circumstances. Having the unions really focus on sort of old functions inherited from the state socialist era, you know, handing out goods at holidays, taking care of workers with special family difficulties, that kind of thing. And then nudging capital and labor into line. So setting things up like a harmonious enterprises initiative that rewards bosses who follow local labor laws, giving labor NGOs some office space, but steering them clear of more sensitive programming, that kind of thing. That's what I call the orthodox approach, and it works when you have contained or maybe at most kind of boundary spanning resistance from workers. And it doesn't just work, it's kind of a smart bet for local officials, because mixing things up, introducing something new, could always inadvertently feed unrest where there isn't that much already. So their incentives are completely to just keep things going as they are, gently keep everything in line. But once you get more boundary spanning and then outright transgressive activism, the calculus for officials is a little bit different. Now the risk is to be viewed in the eyes of their superiors as not doing enough in the face of rising contention. And so they'll start to mix things up and take a more experimental approach, more risk-taking approach. That means, first of all, being in a more reactive role, not trying to monitor everything, not trying to get ahead of every strike and protest, but focusing their energy on big flare-ups, experimenting when it comes to labor laws. So, for example, in Guangdong, you see the province coming close in some of its cities to recognizing the sort of normalness of striking and pushing the local trade union to have elections for his enterprise level union leaders, that kind of thing, but also cracking down much harder on labor activists in particular, maybe taking a somewhat tougher line with businesses, but coming down on labor activists in particular. So leaving that nudging behind and ungloving the fist or whatever metaphor is, and just smacking down opposition.
So kind of more, it's interesting. It's not clearly like repression or not, because in a certain sense, you're saying it's maybe less repressive because of this innovation in institutions saying, okay, we need to find a channel for people to, express workplace grievances and get them resolved, and, you know, or maybe even, you know, go so far as legally go on strike if they're being mistreated or underpaid or whatever enough. But also then being much more harsh with sort of, I guess, expanding the space of what's permitted and setting up new institutions, but then being even harsher on those who cross the line. Would that be kind of the summary?
That's right. And the way I see it, this doesn't have to happen via some sort of big master plan. Each arm of the local government acts in the way it knows how. So the public security system starts really swinging into gear and smashing worker organizations, but the trade union starts acting on various proposals that have been put its way for being more responsive to workers, channeling workers' desires better. Labor bureaus maybe inspect a little bit more, or in the case of some parts of Guangdong, you know, come up with blacklists of employers that have frequently violated the law or been behind in various payments that they're owed, that kind of thing. So each part of the government does what it knows best, whether by design or by accident. And the result then is these different sort of regional models of control. You've got, you know, lots of provinces in China, lots of cities, a lot of diversity in local economic structures and state capacity. But in general, those are the two sort of archetypes I'm putting forward, a sort of orthodox way of controlling things, and then this more risk-taking way of controlling things that's both harsher and more conciliatory at once.
So I feel like, you know, because you mentioned your background and it kind of comes out a little bit in the book, I think there's an element where, you know, you're thinking about this from the worker's perspective of like what works and what gets better outcomes or progress towards a more just system or however you might define it. I don't want to put too many words in your mouth, but I'm not sure, but I'm curious what you think is the answer based on what you found. So you found that, you know, there are different models that result in different, you know, different strategies by the workers, and then different responses from the state. But if you were going to recommend a strategy to a worker activist in China, based on your research, is there a recommendation you could make?
The more I've studied China, the more I feel like I'm the right thing to do is to defer to people on the ground, and the more I'm sort of in awe of how many variables activists have to juggle in their heads at any given moment, and you know, the less likely I'd be to offer any advice. But you know, just based on their actions, I think workers in China have, you know, weighed the downside and the upside of putting pressure on the government, and they've found that the upside outweighs the downside. So the repression so far seems, in their eyes, to have been worth the concessions that they wring both from their employers and from the government. So the sort of general advice would be to keep pushing. And I think most activists in China know that you have to engage in this sort of a delicate dance of exactly how far you push and when to step back and when to engage the government and when to put some distance between oneself and the government.
Okay. So I interviewed, kind of going on to the next step, which I think builds from what we're just saying. You know, I interviewed Yao Li last week for her book about protests. And, you know, her emphasis was on the idea that Chinese protesters are playing by the rules, which is, an idea I've put forward in my work also. And that tends to place a lot more agency with the government as a rule setter. But your emphasis is very much on the other side. It's like that taking the sort of, you know, the exogenous thing is the change in worker strategies. And I think we all know that there's a lot of feedback loops, you know, going every direction. But how do you distinguish one from the other? What kind of evidence, you know, pushes you more towards the idea of saying that really the kind of agency or the first mover is with the workers versus it being with the government, or versus, you know, a third view would be maybe kind of what we'd call a structural view, that there's some, economic or social variables that vary across provinces or across time, and that those drive the sort of equilibrium responses by both workers and the state.
Well, it's obviously, like you said, circular to some degree, and partially just a question of emphasis, whether one's focusing more on bottom-up pressures or top-down policies. I do a couple things in the book to try to isolate the bottom-up pressures from those top-down policies. And one is just running some statistical analysis of rates of strikes, protests, and riots, and then having as my outcome pro-worker or split decisions in mediation, arbitration, and court on the one hand, sort of a rough measure of responsiveness, basically the government's willingness to set aside the interests of powerful local employers and make concessions to workers, and then spending on the paramilitary people's armed police on the other. And what I find is that more worker unrest leads to more split or pro-worker decisions and fewer pro-business decisions, and it means more spending on police. And if I go a little bit further and sort of instrument on the past values of labor unrest, so go back a couple steps so that we're sure that the labor unrest isn't being shaped by a police spending or court decisions in the same period, you see the same pattern there. So you can see that they're still driving a police spending in particular. You do see some obvious feedback from court decisions. So you see that labor unrest in turn is responding to pro-worker and split decisions, but you see it still driving down sort of outright pro-business decisions. So that's sort of the statistical attempt to deal with that issue. The other thing I do is look at a third sort of shadow case of Chongqing and argue that Chongqing is the kind of place where you would expect to see labor reforms, if anywhere, if the reforms basically start from the top rather than at workers' initiative. And the reason I say you would expect to see reforms in Chongqing is one, it's a dynamic place, a growing economy, lots of investment flowing in there. And two, for a good chunk of time, it was run by first Wang Yang, sort of liberal reformist, and then, of course, by Bo Xilai, the sort of left populist reformist. And they, if anyone, albeit for different personal reasons, would seem like the kind of people who'd want to jump in and tweak the way industrial relations were run. But I show that across both of their administrations in Chongqing, you didn't really see anything innovative when it came to labor law, the role of the trade union, any of that. Some little tweaks, but nothing that strayed too far from national legislation. But when Wang Yang was transferred to Guangdong, he jumped right in, passed a number of local laws, oversaw a relatively progressive handling of some major strikes, etc. My argument is that basically reformists are reformists. People in the government who want to shake things up will want to shake things up, but they'll only focus on labor issues when there are big labor issues to focus on. So the momentum still comes from what's happening at the grassroots.
Okay, but then what about at the national level? You know, you've alluded to, you know, obviously that things in general have become a lot tighter under Xi Jinping. You know, to what extent? Well, first of all, you know, how you know, I know your research period kind of, you know, overlapped that. Like a lot of your quantitative data is from the prior period, but then a lot of your field research was during the early years of the Xi Jinping's control, and obviously you've been following this closely since then. So, you know, how much, you know, what has changed under him? How much do you think, like, was it under him or was it sort of pre-existing trends that he just kind of pushed a little bit further? And how does that affect our view of, you know, the extent to which things are top down versus bottom up? If it's, you know, if to take one view would just be, oh, Xi Jinping came in and he just likes control, and so now there's a lot more control and a lot less space to do anything.
Well, it certainly is true that there's a lot less space to do things now than before he came to power. Looking at the strike data from China Labor Bulletin rather than my data set and police spending numbers, et cetera, it does seem like the patterns break down a bit after Xi. But it's a little bit hard to say because the People's Armed Police numbers aren't available after 2009. And again, I'm relying on China Labor Bulletin strike data rather than my own. So there might be some, you know, difference in counting right there. There's also maybe been some centralization of certain things, especially spending, that further confuses the analysis. At any rate, though, like people who read my book really carefully will notice not just that a lot of the data is from the Hu Wen era, but that the repression of labor activists that I discuss is really weighted toward the last years covered by the book, especially 2015, when a number of activists in Guangdong were detained and a couple of them were put on trial. And then again in 2018, 2019, when the same thing happened again, in addition to this crackdown on Marxist students. The labor NGOs that went the furthest in terms of being a part of collective bargaining and that sort of thing have been cracked down really harshly. While others have been pushed out or just driven into kind of mild service-oriented programming. As in 2008, right after the financial crisis, post-COVID, there's been a real push to loosen the regulatory burden on companies, which has meant weaker enforcement of labor laws in some respects. And even before COVID, there was some talk under Xi among certain officials that the labor contract law had gone too far and that sort of thing. But I think there's been a real responsiveness where there's been a real push. So the Xi administration made a big deal a few years back of cutting back excess capacity in coal and steel. And when there were big strikes up in the Northeast among those old state sector miners, they backtracked and slowed things down. More recently, you've seen the government make a big push, at least rhetorically, against abuses in the gig economy, especially among food delivery workers. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I don't think it's a coincidence that follows on a lot of activism among delivery workers, strikes by delivery workers, protests, and a couple sad instances of self-immolation. And I think it's maybe worth mentioning too that there were some really big crackdowns long before Xi was a part of the picture. If we go back to that state-owned enterprise activism that predates the period covered by my book, you saw massive deployments of the People's Armed Police up to the Northeast, workers getting 10-year sentences for their activism, reports of, at least in one instance, a tank being pulled out into the streets. So I think there's just a lot more continuity than people usually think.
Yeah, it does seem like there's a lot of, sometimes listening to the discourse about all the, absolutely troubling things happening under Xi and the human rights abuses, around the country, it's easy to sometimes, I get this thing like the counterfactual. There's this sort of imaginary past that people are thinking of, right. Like back when China was. I mean, I don't think anyone would say that if you say, if you actually ask them, was China really such a, an awesome open society before? I don't think anyone who knows anything or even, has, read a book or two would think that. But yet it somehow seems implicit that the 90s or early 2000s were, I guess the point is there was sort of a relative golden era, but there's never been a period where it wasn't an autocratic state that was willing to use repression when it felt it needed to maintain control or achieve whatever political objectives. So I think it's good to acknowledge those changes, but not forget that this country has a long history of violence and repression in a lot of different eras through the present.
Yeah, and I wonder if sort of the big difference was sort of people's projections into the future back then more than what they were noticing around them, or maybe rather that their projections of sort of future Chinese political liberalization made them sort of discount some things they saw around them and highlight other things, and they now their projections make them look at other things. I had a paper out last year with Yao Li, who you just interviewed, looking at the likelihood of a protest resulting in sort of really overt repression, given local police spending under Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao and versus Xi Jinping, and maybe you got into this in your interview with her, but what we found was that, on average under Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, somewhere that spent more on police was less likely to crack down on a protest, or rather a protest in such a place was less likely to be cracked down upon. And then the opposite was true under Xi. So, coercive capacity is the way we thought of it. Coercive capacity was being deployed differently. But maybe the most interesting thing we found, from my perspective at least, is that inflection point, happened before Xi came into office. So it happened right after the Olympics around 2009 or so. What's the takeaway there? It's that the Xi era is obviously more repressive, but maybe his policies are the result of some sort of elite consensus that had started to form even before he came to office, and that he's maybe more a product of than a cause of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does. I mean, also just your finding is really fascinating, because we're always, in the U.S. also, discussions of defund the police and how do we deal with, excessive police violence, and one line of argument, which is certainly plausible, is if you have less police and they're less, less armed, you'll have more peaceful outcomes. And, certainly there's instances where, it seems like the police, local police departments go and raid the army surplus store and get themselves, tanks, and, they buy a missile if they could. And, once you've got those toys, then there's a sense that you'll want to use them. But then on the other hand, there's the idea that, when you're, if you're well-armed and confident and you do know what you're doing, then you can actually avoid violence. And that was an argument that was made in China around the 1989 repression, that, what happened in Beijing, there would have been, there still would have been repression, but instead of it being with tanks and guns, because they just had, they had a military, They could have been with, fire hoses and tear gas and rubber bullets, which, you know, is harsh enough, but it's not the same as lead bullets. So you can kind of see it going both ways. And it's interesting to hear that in the Who era, it was more, being better armed, let you kind of, I mean, to overstate, but it seemed like it was associated with the police being a little bit more calmer and even-handed, or the local authorities being calmer, calm and even-handed in their use of the police. Whereas under C, it's more like, well, now we have the toys, and if we're, if you stand up to us, we're gonna be strong China. Just as they're being a little bit, more macho in a sense abroad, they're also being a little bit more macho with discontent domestically.
So the politics obviously matter, not just the equipment available.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been great. So before we go, I wanted to ask you just a couple more things, not about the book. So first, I know you've continued working on these areas, but what are you working on now? Are you pushing more research on labor activism or opening up new areas? What's happening with you now?
I've started to shift to some related but still distinct topics. So I've got a paper under review right now with an Egypt scholar or Middle East scholar, Killian Clark, looking at lumpen proletarians, like small criminals, odd jobs workers, or chronically unemployed people in China versus Egypt. We've all read reports about these people being hired as thugs to beat up farmers, to beat up workers, hired by local authorities or local economic elites. But we've also heard about them escalating protests out of control in places like Wang'an and that sort of thing. So we're looking at what kind of incidents tend to draw in these people on the side of protesters, and how the sort of nature of their participation can change between a sort of relatively stable situation like China's versus a situation that's more in flux in Egypt. So that's one project. Another is I'm starting on a comparative project about contentious politics in Shanxi and maybe China's northwest more generally, and West Virginia and maybe America's Appalachia more generally. I lived in Shanxi for a couple of years after college, and the mine wars and all that other resistance in Appalachia are something that's always just kind of pulled at my heartstrings. So for now, I'm just reading lots of books about Appalachia in particular. And it's a bit of a comparison in search of a good research question at this point. But those are two things that I'm working on right now.
The last thing I wanted to ask you was, just as a fun thing, do you have any recommendations for our listeners?
Yeah, I've got two recommendations. One comes from that Appalachia Shanxi project I'm starting. And the other is a website. So the first one is a book by Stephen Stoll, who's a historian, from 2017 called Ramp Hollow, The Ordeal of Appalachia. We're all familiar with the process of enclosing the commons in Britain. And this book explains how American mountaineers, people like Daniel Boone and so on, moved into the hard-to-farm parts of the Appalachians as essentially squatters on land owned by wealthy people like George Washington, following the genocide of nations like the Shawnee and, of course, the Cherokee. But then these people themselves were forced into the mines when both the mining and, before that, the timber industry destroyed the forests that these mountaineers relied on as a foraging space for their animals, as hunting grounds, and as a source of wild plants like the ramps that give the book its name. It's just a really well-written book and a really sad one. The other recommendation is the Cornell University ILR School. That's the Industrial and Labor Relations School's A Strike Tracker, which can be found at Strike Tracker. ilr.cornell.edu. It's a really similar strike map to mine and to China Labor Bulletins, but it's focused on the United States. So America's Bureau of Labor Statistics only tracks strikes that are bigger than 1,000 people, or it's only done that since the Reagan era. And there have been some little private efforts to fill in the gap, like Bloomberg has something called the Bloomberg BNA Labor Plus data set or something like that. And there's a journalist named Mike Elk who started a similar map to Cornell's early on during the COVID pandemic. But Cornell's promises to be much more comprehensive. And so far, they've pulled together like 160 some incidents the last time I checked yesterday over the past couple years. And they're just constantly adding more and are pretty transparent about how they go about finding these.
Are they going back in history or just trying to collect things going forward?
My impression is that they're primarily trying to track things going forward, but I saw a couple incidents from the past couple years. So maybe they're also trying to start reaching back. My guess is they'll document 2021 onward the best.
Right. Well, that sounds like it'll be a great resource for political scientists and economists wanting to understand the interaction between labor and business in the U.S.
Yeah, and making comparisons to places like China.
Right, right. Yeah, actually, your point about the Xi Jinping and Hu Jintao contrast of, you know, whether more equipment leads to more or less violence. I guess strikes in the U.S. tend to, you know, be met with violence much, much less in general. But anyway, it should be a lot of
At least cool nowadays stuff. They do.
Least nowadays, right, right. we have a history, a pretty bloody history from the earlier years, that's for sure. Okay, well, thank you very much. That's about all the time I have. But thanks so much for being on the show. I really enjoyed having you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation too.